No matter how much I pulled my legs close, they were still outside the door. The sniper next to me was stuck with one leg inside the cabin and the other outside of it. It is hard to describe the feeling of riding a helicopter into the ground. I don't think my mind fully grasped what was happening. I had it in my mind that maybe I could stay in the door like a Looney Tunes cartoon character. You know, when the house falls off the cliff and the character escapes by opening the front door. For a split second, I figured that when the helicopter hit and rolled, I'd land in the door and be safe. The privacy wall around the compound quickly passed by as we headed for the ground. When the helicopter rotated 90 degrees, the tail rotor barely missed the wall on the south side of the compound. I could feel fear grip my chest as the ground rushed toward me. I had no control, and I think that scared me most of all. I always figured I would probably die in a gunfight, not in a helicopter crash. We were all used to stacking the odds in our favor. We knew the dangers, we did the battlefield calculus, and we trusted our skills. But clinging to a helicopter, there was nothing we could do. Seconds before impact, I felt the nose dip. I held my breath and waited for impact. The helicopter shuddered as the nose dug into the soft ground like a lawn dart. One minute, the ground was rushing up at me. The next minute, I was at a dead stop. It happened so fast, I didn't even feel the impact. The blades didn't snap off. Instead, the rotors blasted the muddy courtyard, blowing dust and debris and creating a maelstrom around us. I exhaled and blinked the dust out of my eyes. Squinting against the assault of rocks and dust, I realized we were still about 6 feet above the ground at a steep angle. "Get the fuck out!" Walt yelled at me, shoving me forward. I dropped from the cabin and landed in the courtyard in a crouch. Despite wearing more than 60 pounds of gear, I didn't feel the weight or the jolt from the fall. Without looking back, I ran forward like an Olympic sprinter away from the wreck. Sliding to a halt about 30 yards away, I turned back and saw the wreckage for the first time. When the helicopter crashed, the tail boom got caught up on the 12-foot privacy wall. The tail's single load-bearing section propped the Black Hawk up and kept the rotors from hitting the ground. If any other part of the helicopter hit the wall, or if we had tipped and the rotor hit the ground first, none of us would be walking away unscathed. Teddy and his co-pilot had somehow pulled off the impossible. I could see my teammates dropping out of the cabin and dashing through a gap underneath the helicopter as it rested at an angle against the wall. Like my teammates, I had gotten good at compartmentalizing stressful situations over my career, and now I had to block the crash out. 2 minutes ago, I was pissed we were going to land outside the compound, but now we were alive and on the ground inside the walls. Despite the near disaster, the mission was still on track. My teammates were already headed to the gates that led us back into the main compound. I needed to get my ass in gear because if Charlie or Walt saw me standing there while they were already moving to their positions, I would never hear the end of their shit-talking. We had scheduled 30 minutes to complete the mission based on the helicopter's fuel consumption and a possible response time from the Pakistanis. We had built in an additional 10 minutes of flex time, just in case. Running back toward the helicopter, I figured we needed those extra minutes now. The way the helicopter was perched on the wall, I didn't have enough room to clear the rotors in the front. It was dark, and even with my night vision, it was impossible to be sure how high the rotors were spinning. The only way to get to the compound was by going underneath the wreck. "I am going explosive," I heard Charlie say over the troop net. I could see him at the gate to the main compound setting the charge. Putting my head down, I raced toward the wreck. As I got close, I tried to hug the wall as I ran underneath the tail boom. Hot exhaust blew down from the engines as I passed. It was like walking inside a hairdryer for a few seconds. Coming out on the other side, I could see Charlie prepping a charge on the locked iron gate. All around him were guys with their weapons trained out, pulling security. I moved toward a prayer room near the gate to make sure it was clear. The room had a large open area with thick rugs on the floor and pillows forming a perimeter around the walls. We knew from the intelligence analysts that the room was most likely used to meet guests, but that seemed to be infrequent. Once cleared, I pulled off an IR chem light and threw it by the door to alert the others the room was secure. When I got back outside, Charlie was checking his back blast to make sure no one could get hit by shrapnel from the breaching charge. I saw the quick flash as Charlie hit the detonator and smoothly rolled back out of the way like he had done thousands of times. We all dipped our heads to protect our eyes. No one was panicked or nervous. We were on the ground, and finally it was up to us to get the job done. The explosion sent a shockwave that blew a hole in the gate. Charlie was the first through, kicking and pulling the scorched metal wider so we could fit. Guys quickly started to pile through and peel off toward their planned objectives. Despite the first few curveballs, we were now back on our original plan. After clearing the gate, I caught a glimpse of the second Blackhawk carrying Chalk 2. I could tell by the way the helicopter was hovering that Chalk 2 had already landed the perimeter security team outside the walls of the compound. From the dozens of times we had trained in the mock-up, I was used to getting rotor wash in the face as the helicopter hovered over the building while the teams fast-roped onto the roof. But instead of hovering above the house, the helicopter quickly disappeared behind the walls. The pilots must have seen us crash and set back down to drop the team off outside the walls. "Don't worry about risking a bad position with the helicopters. Just get the guys on the ground," Admiral McCraven had reiterated during one of our final briefs. "It doesn't matter where. The most important thing is to get them on the ground safe, and they'll figure out the rest." I guess Chalk 2 hadn't wanted to gamble with fast roping to the main building after seeing what happened to our helicopter. It was the right call. I could hear the first few radio calls starting to chime in over the net. I knew from contingency planning that if Chalk 2 didn't fast rope onto the roof, they were headed to a gate on the north side of the compound. Heading towards C1, Will was next to me as we approached the front door of the guest house. The only sound that gave us away was the scuff of our boots on the gravel. We knew that as one of bin Laden's most trusted couriers, Ahmed al-Kuwaiti lived in the guest house with his family. We expected at least one wife and several children. Since the kids lived there, I didn't expect any booby traps. Just like on the mock-up and pictures, there was a set of metal double doors with windows at the top. A window on the right side of the door had bars covering the glass. I didn't see any lights on in the house. Sheets covered all of the windows, making it impossible to see inside. Will took up a position to the left of the door while I tried the knob. I pulled down the L-shaped handle twice, but it was locked. Stepping back, Will popped his sledgehammer off the back of his kit and pulled out the extendable handle. I covered him from the right. Will reared back and hit the lock with a sharp whack. The hammer slammed into the knob, but only left a battered handle and a deep gash. Will gave it two more whacks, but nothing budged. The doors were solid metal, and we knew the sledgehammer wasn't going to work. Turning to the windows, Will tried to smash out the glass so we could pull the sheet down and look inside. Wedging the head of the hammer through the bars, he tried to break the panes of glass, but each time he pulled back, the head of the hammer got jammed. The bars were just too narrow. "I'm going explosive," I whispered to Will, and grabbed the breaching charge off the back of my kit. We both knew that time was of the essence, and the element of surprise was gone the minute our helicopter crashed. Will set the sledgehammer aside and covered the door with his rifle. From across the compound, there was an explosion as the team from Chalk 2 blew the north gate open. "Failed breach," came over the radio. "We're moving to the Delta compound gate at this time." After blowing the gate open, they had discovered a brick wall sealing it. The team was supposed to be assaulting the third floor by now, but they were still trying to gain entry. "Roger, I will meet you there and unlock it from the inside," Mike replied. Delta Gate was at the north end of the driveway that separated the helicopter crash with the rest of the compound. Mike was on the south end of the driveway, close to the guest house. The mission was moving quickly now. It had probably been about 5 minutes since we hit the ground, and now 24 guys were swarming the compound. At least two charges had blown, and coupled with the helicopters, we knew they had heard us coming. Without a doubt, we figured the occupants of the compound would now be prepared to defend themselves. Taking a knee to the right of the door, I peeled the backing off the adhesive strip on the breaching charge and set it across the mangled knob and lock. I always knelt while I placed breaching charges because I had been shot at through the door in Iraq many times. Fighters like to spray the middle of the door, blindly firing where they thought a man would be standing. The third member of my team entered the compound. He was one of the last guys out of the helicopter and had just gotten to us. His job was to clear a staircase that led to the roof of the guest house. As he started toward the stairs, which were directly in line with the door, AK-47 rounds tore through the glass above the door, narrowly missing him. I rolled away as the bullets cracked just inches over my head. The first rounds always surprise the shit out of you. I could feel pieces of glass hit my shoulder. "That is not a suppressed weapon," I thought. It was easy to tell who was firing, since we had suppressors on our weapons. Unsuppressed rounds meant enemy fire. Someone inside had an assault rifle. Aiming chest high, he fired a blind barrage. He was a caged animal. There was nowhere he could go, and he knew we were coming. Will, covering the door from the left side, started to fire back instantly. As I turned back and opened fire, I felt a searing burn in my left shoulder, probably glass or shrapnel. Our return fire cut through the metal door. Rolling out of the fatal funnel of the doorway, I made it to my feet and moved to the window a few feet down the wall from the door. "Ahmed al-Kuwaiti," Will said. "Ahmed al-Kuwaiti, come out!" Smashing the window with my barrel, I fired back toward his likely position. Will was still yelling, and with no response. With no time to spare, I made my way back to the explosive charge, which was still hanging from the door. The only way to get inside was to blow the door. As I got close, I made sure to stay extra low. Once we blew the door, I planned to throw a grenade inside before we went in to clear it. Ahmed al-Kuwaiti had proven he wasn't going down without a fight, and I was not going to risk anything. I was about to attach the detonator to the charge when we heard someone throwing the latch to the lock. Will heard it too, and we both immediately started to back away from the door. We had no idea who was coming out or what to expect. Was he going to just crack the door and throw a grenade, or hang his AK-47 out and spray? I took a quick look around. There was no cover. The courtyard was crowded with trash and tools used to garden. Our only option was to continue moving back, trying to stay away from the window and door. The door cracked open slowly, and I could hear a woman's voice calling out. That didn't mean we were safe. If she was coming out with a suicide vest on, we were dead. This was Bin Laden's compound. These were his facilitators. Shots were fired, so we knew they were willing to die to protect him. Through the sweat running down my face and the grit in my eyes from the rotor wash, I could just make out the figure of a woman in the green glow of my night vision goggles. She had something in her arms, and my fingers slowly started applying pressure to my trigger. I could see our lasers dancing around her head. It would only take a split second to end her life if she was holding a bomb. As the door continued to open, I saw that the bundle was a baby. Al-Kuwaiti's wife, Mariam, came out with the child pressed against her chest. Behind her, three more kids shuffled out of the house. "Come here," Will called out to her in Arabic. I kept my rifle trained on them as they moved forward. "He is dead," Mariam said to Will in Arabic. "You shot him. He is dead. You killed him." Will did a quick pat down of the woman. "Hey, she is saying he's dead," Will said to me, translating her Arabic. I was crouched at the right side of the door and pushed it open. I spotted a pair of feet lying in the doorway of the bedroom. There was no way of knowing if he was still alive, and I wasn't taking any chances. Will gave me a squeeze on the shoulder so I knew he was ready, and we entered the hallway. I shouldered my rifle and squeezed off several rounds to make sure he was down. The house smelled of heating oil. Stepping over Al-Kuwaiti's body, I saw a pistol and an AK-47 on the ground just inside the bedroom door. I kicked them away and continued to clear the room, which had a bed in the center, and then smaller beds along the walls for the children. The whole family slept in the same room. On the other side of the hall was a kitchen area. Our return fire had destroyed the room, shredding the pantry and exploding dry goods all over. Water trickled off the counter. The stove had several holes in it, and the cheap tile was smashed with chunks strewn across the counter and floor. The floor was slippery from the water and Al-Kuwaiti's blood, which had pooled in the hall and gotten on our boots. We hastily cleared both rooms and headed outside. "Shots fired, C-1, building is secure at this time," I said over the troop net, and tossed an IR chem light at the guest house's front door. We moved toward the main building to backfill the other teams. Chapter 14. Khalid. Not even 10 minutes had passed since we crashed. Will and I sprinted through the open gate between the guest house and the main compound. We were headed toward the north door of A-1. "Explosive set, north door A-1, Charlie said over the troop net. His charge was set, and he was waiting for the order to blow the north door. All Charlie and Walt needed now was the radio call from Tom to initiate. Jen and her analysts were right so far. They suspected that the house was split into a duplex. The Bin Laden family lived on the second and third floors with their own private entrance. The Pacer always came out the north door, but the Al-Kuwaiti brothers always used the south door. Unsure if a hallway ran between the north and south doors, we didn't want to risk two explosive breaches at the same time. So Tom and his team had come up with a plan to clear the south side of the house first, while Charlie waited for Tom's radio call before setting off the explosive charge. Tom's three-man team was inside, clearing the first floor. Inside the building was dark, almost pitch black, but under night vision, they could easily make out the hallway and four doors opening off the long hall, two on each side. Tom's team was no more than a few steps inside the house when the point man spotted a man's head sticking out of the first room on the left. They had already heard the unmistakable sound of AK-47 fire coming from the guest house, and they weren't taking any chances. There was ample time for whoever was in A1 to get ready to put up a fight. The point man snapped off a shot. The round struck the occupant, later confirmed to be Abrar al-Kuwaiti, and he disappeared into the room. Slowly moving down the hall, the man stopped at the door. Abrar al-Kuwaiti was wounded and struggling on the floor. Just as they opened fire again, his wife Bushrat jumped in the way to shield him. The second burst of rounds killed both of them. The team saw another woman and several children huddled in the corner, crying. An AK-47 was in the room. Grabbing the rifle, Tom unloaded it while the rest of the team searched the remaining rooms. At the end of the hall was a locked door, which was directly in line with the north door. With the south side of A1 secure, Tom's team quickly exited. Usually, we would have left someone to watch the woman and kids in the bedroom, but we didn't have the time or enough assaulters. The remaining woman and kids were just left in the room. "Hey, Charlie, send it," Tom said on the troop net. As they exited the south door, one of the SEALs threw Abrar al-Kuwaiti's AK-47 into the courtyard. It was dark, and there was little chance anyone would come out looking for it. Seconds after hearing the call from Tom over the radio, I heard the boom as Charlie set off his breaching charge. Will and I had made our way around the west side of the building and stacked behind the guys lined up to enter the north door, which was now open. The SEALs from Chalk 2 had by now made their way into the compound. After the failed breach, they had moved over to the main gate and were let in by Mike. They were already stacked on the north door. Charlie was already inside, and a loose line had formed as the rest of us waited to enter the target. Through my night vision, I could see multiple lasers tracking along the windows and balconies just in case. Scanning my laser above me toward the second and third floor, I didn't see any movement. Coating on the windows made it impossible to see in or out. All of the rushing around had begun to slow. Things were going very smoothly since the crash 10 minutes ago. We all wanted to continue the assault up the stairs, but Charlie reported over the radio that an additional metal gate was blocking our path to the second floor. Charlie was busy setting his third explosive charge of the night. All we could do was wait and pull security. I knew Charlie and the others were working as fast as they possibly could. While I was standing there, I began to think about how surreal it all was. It felt like waiting to start a CQB run during Green Team. The sound of some pissed-off chickens pulled me from my thoughts. Our route to the north door had taken us through a small area of latticework and chicken coops. Our bulletproof vests and tactical gear were getting hung up in the narrow walkway, smashing the coops. Standing in one place was driving me crazy. Just in front of me, I could hear a couple of guys talking. "Holy shit, I can't believe we just crashed," Walt said. "Crashed? What the fuck are you talking about?" "Yeah, our helo just crashed," Walt said. Standing nearby was Jay, the mission's commander, who had been on Chalk 2. When he heard Walt talk about the crash, he quickly cut in. "What?" "Yeah, we crashed," Walt said, motioning back toward the crash site. "You might want to take a look in the courtyard." Even through night vision, I thought it looked funny as the expression on Jay's face changed as he processed the information. He turned and sprinted back down the line of assaulters. I guess no one from Chalk 2 knew we crashed. At this point, it had not been broadcast over the net. When the pilots of Chalk 2 saw Chalk 1 go down in the courtyard, they had skipped the risky fast rope onto the roof and landed Chalk 2 outside the walls. Back at the helicopter, Teddy and his crew were shutting down the engines and making sure all of the instruments were destroyed. For a second, he considered attempting to take off again. There was no major visible damage to the helicopter, and he figured with no weight he might be able to lift off. In the end, caution won out. After rushing to the scene of the crash, Jay immediately got on the satellite radio he was carrying and called the QRF. The QRF quickly took off from their initial position, located with the second CH-47 a short distance north of the compound, and headed our way. To save time, they took the most direct route over Pakistan's military academy. But a few minutes later, Jay called back. Although we had crash-landed, we didn't have any dead or wounded. All the assaulters were consolidated on A1, and they were about to start clearing up the stairs. "Hold your position," he said to the QRF. Inside A1, Charlie set his next breaching charge and checked the backblast. Since the charge was going to explode inside the building, the overpressure was more dynamic and would blow out windows and doors. Two other SEALs were near Charlie. With almost zero cover to shield them from the blast, one SEAL was hiding behind a door that led to another room. "Hey, buddy, you might want to watch out for that door," Charlie said. The assaulter stepped away from behind the door just as Charlie set off the charge. I could hear the loud boom echo from my position outside at the chicken coops. The overpressure blew the door the SEAL had been hiding behind from its hinges and sent it crashing into the opposite wall. The SEAL stood there, stunned. A few seconds ago, he was in the path and would have likely been seriously injured if he hadn't moved. "Thanks," he said to Charlie, as they both pushed and pulled open the mangled gate. With the gate open, we started clearing up the stairs. It took a few seconds for me to get to the door. I hooked right through the second metal gate and began heading up the stairs. Most of the guys were already ahead of me. The tile stairs were set at 90-degree angles, creating a sort of spiral staircase separated by small landings. We had no idea what to expect. By now, Bin Laden, or whoever was hiding inside, had plenty of time to get a weapon and prepare a defense. Since the only way up was through a spiraling staircase, we could easily get bottlenecked. It was dark, and we were doing our best to be quiet. Every step was deliberate. No talking, no yelling, no running. In the old days, we'd storm the castle, throwing flash grenades as we cleared through an objective. Now, we stayed as quiet as possible. We had the advantage with our night vision, but it would be lost if you went barreling into a room. It was all about throttle control. There was no reason to run to our deaths. When I reached the landing on the second deck, most of the other assaulters had fanned out. The second floor opened into a long hallway heading to a terrace that ran along the south side of the building. The floor had four doors, two right near the landing and two farther down near the terrace. I could see my teammates creeping down the hall, stacking on the doors before quietly clearing inside. I noticed another assaulter three or four steps up the stairs, holding security on the landing between the second and third decks. A body was on the landing. Blood was trickling out onto the marble floor. While holding security, the assaulter had seen a man quickly poke his head down and around the landing. Intelligence reports said there could be up to four males living at the compound. Khalid, one of Bin Laden's sons, was most likely living on the second floor, while Bin Laden lived on the third floor. The head, peeking around the corner, was clean cut, with no beard. It had to be Bin Laden's son. "Khalid," the assaulter whispered. "Khalid." Everyone in the compound had heard the helicopter engines. They heard the shots fired at the guest house, and they heard the explosive breaches. But by then, everything was quiet again. All they could hear was our footsteps. Then the man on the landing heard his name being called. "They know my name?" I imagine him thinking. Curiosity got the best of him, and he stuck his head out to see who was calling his name. The second he stuck his head back around the corner, the assaulter shot him in the face. His body rolled down the stairs and rested on the landing. Looking back, I saw we had several more SEALs coming up the stairs and beginning to stack behind me. The second floor hallway was already full of assaulters, and they didn't need any more help. The only place to go was up. Standing behind the point man, I gave him a squeeze to let him know we were ready. "Take it." Chapter 15. Third Deck. Khalid was splayed out on his back, and we had to carefully pick our way past him on the stairs. The steps were slick tile, made slicker by the blood. Each step was precarious. Nearby, I saw Khalid's AK-47 rifle propped on the step. I am glad he didn't man up and use that thing, I thought. Had the point man not called his name, we could have been pinned down on the stairwell. All he had to do was sit on the landing and fire a few rounds each time we tried to move up the stairs toward his position. That would have been a nightmare, and we would have taken some casualties for sure. We had planned for more of a fight. For all the talk about suicide vests and being willing to shed blood for Allah, only one of the Al-Kuwaiti brothers got off a barrage. At least Khalid had thought about it. When we examined his AK-47 later, we learned he had a round in the chamber. He was prepared to fight, but in the end, he hadn't gotten much of an opportunity. The stairwell was pitch black to the naked eye, but under our night vision, everything was bathed in a green hue. The assaulter holding security was now on point as we followed him up the stairs. We were again slowing down and taking our time. The point man was the eyes and ears for the rest of us. He controlled the pace. Throttle on, throttle off. So far, everything was adding up. We knew the house had at least four men. The only one left was bin Laden. But I pushed those thoughts out of my head. It didn't matter who it was on the third deck. We were possibly walking into a gunfight, and most gunfights at this range only last a few seconds. There was no margin of error. Focus, I told myself. With the point man directly in front of me, there was nothing much I could do. I was there to support him. Roughly 15 minutes had passed, and bin Laden had plenty of time to strap on a suicide vest or simply get his gun. My eyes scanned the landing up ahead. My senses were on overdrive, my ears strained to hear a round being chambered or the footsteps of someone approaching. Nothing we were doing was new. We had all been on hundreds of missions. At the most basic level, we were clearing rooms, like we learned in Green Team. Only the target and the fact that we were in Pakistan made this mission significant. The landing at the top of the stairs opened into a narrow hallway. At the end of the hall was a door to the balcony. Roughly 5 feet from the top of the stairs were two doors, one to the right and one to the left. The stairway was relatively narrow, especially for a bunch of guys in kit. It was difficult to see around the point man since the stairwell and landing narrowed as we got to the top. We were less than 5 steps from getting to the top when I heard suppressed shots. Bop, bop. The point man had seen a man peeking out of the door on the right side of the hallway about 10 feet in front of him. I couldn't tell from my position if the rounds hit the target or not. The man disappeared into the dark room. The point man reached the landing first and slowly moved toward the door. Unlike in the movies, we didn't bound up the final few steps and rush into the room with guns blazing. We took our time. The point man kept his rifle trained into the room as we slowly crept toward the open door. Again, we didn't rush. Instead, we waited at the threshold and peered inside. We could see two women standing over a man lying at the foot of his bed. Both women were dressed in long gowns, and their hair was a tangled mess like they had been sleeping. The women were hysterically crying and wailing in Arabic. The younger one looked up and saw us at the door. She yelled out in Arabic and rushed the point man. We were less than 5 feet apart. Swinging his gun to the side, the point man grabbed both women and drove them toward the corner of the room. If either woman had on a suicide vest, he probably saved our lives. But it would have cost him his own. It was a selfless decision, made in a split second. With the women out of the way, I entered the room with a third SEAL. We saw the man lying on the floor at the foot of his bed. He was wearing a white sleeveless t-shirt, loose tan pants, and a tan tunic. The point man's shots had entered the right side of his head. Blood and brains spilled out of the side of his skull. In his death throes, he was still twitching and convulsing. Another assaulter and I trained our lasers on his chest and fired several rounds. The bullets tore into him, slamming his body into the floor until he was motionless. Quickly scanning for additional threats, I saw at least 3 children huddled in the far corner of the room near the sliding glass door that opened onto the balcony. The children, I couldn't tell if they were boys or girls, sat in the corner, stunned, as I cleared the room. With the man on the floor now motionless and no further threat, we cleared 2 small rooms just off the bedroom. Pushing the first door open, I peeked inside and saw a small, cramped, messy office. Papers were strewn all over a tiny desk. The second door, revealed a small shower and toilet. Everything was muscle memory now. In our minds, we started ticking off our mental checklist. The main threat was dead by the bed. The point man was covering the women and kids. My teammate and I cleared the small office and bathroom, while the other SEALs cleared the room across the hall. As I went across the hall to the other room, I passed Walt on the way.
"All clear over here," he said.
"This side, too," I replied. The point man moved the women and kids out of the bedroom and onto the balcony to keep them calm. Tom was on the third deck and saw that both rooms were clear. "Third deck secure," I heard him say over the troop net. Chapter 16. Geronimo. Back in the bedroom, the youngest woman was lying on the bed, screaming hysterically, clutching her calf. Walt was standing next to the body. It was still dark, and it was hard to make out the man's face. The house was still without power. I reached up and flipped on the light clipped into the rail system on my helmet. The target was now secure, and since all the windows were covered, no one could see us from the outside, so the use of white light was safe. The man's face was mangled from at least one bullet wound and covered in blood. A hole in his forehead collapsed the right side of his skull. His chest was torn up from where the bullets had entered his body. He was lying in an ever-growing pool of blood. As I crouched down to take a closer look, Tom joined me.
"I think this is our boy," Tom said.
He wasn't about to say it was Bin Laden over the radio because he knew that call would be shot like lightning back to Washington. We knew President Obama was listening, so we didn't want to be wrong. I went through the checklist in my head. He was very tall. I figured approximately 6'4". Check. He was the one adult male on the third deck. Check. The two couriers were exactly where the CIA said they'd be. Check. The more I looked at his mangled face, my eye seemed to go back to his nose. It wasn't damaged and seemed familiar. Pulling my booklet out of my kit, I studied the composite photos. The long and slender nose fit. His beard was dark black, and there was no trace of the gray that I expected to see. "Walt and I will run with this," I said to Tom.
"Roger,"
Tom said. Taking out my camera and rubber gloves, I started taking photos, while Walt prepared to take multiple sets of DNA samples. Will, the Arabic speaker, was in the room treating the leg wound of the woman crying on the bed. We learned later that she was Amal al-Fatah, Bin Laden's fifth wife. I'm not sure when she got hit, but it was a very small wound. It could have been from bullet fragments or a ricochet. "Hey, we have a significant amount of SSE on the second deck," I heard someone call over the troop net. "We're going to need any extra bodies down here." As Tom left the room, I heard him on the command net. "We have a possible, I repeat, possible touchdown on the third deck." Walt pulled his camelback hose from his kit and squirted water on the man's face. I started to wipe the blood away from his face using a blanket from the bed. With each swipe, the face became more familiar. He looked younger than I expected. His beard was dark, like it had been dyed. I just kept thinking about how he didn't look anything like I'd expected him to look. It was strange to see such an infamous face up close. Lying in front of me was the reason we had been fighting for the last decade. It was surreal, trying to clean blood off the most wanted man in the world so that I could shoot his photo. I had to focus on the mission. Right now, we needed some good, quality photos. This picture could end up being widely viewed, and I didn't want to mess it up. Tossing the blanket away, I pulled out the camera that I'd used to shoot hundreds of pictures over the last few years and started snapping photos. We'd all gotten real good taking these kinds of photos. We'd been playing CSI Afghanistan for years. The first shots were of his full body. Then I knelt down near his head and shot a few of just his face. Pulling his beard to the right and then to the left, I shot several profile pictures. I really wanted to focus on the nose. Because the beard was so dark, the profile shot was the one that really stood out in my mind. "Hey, men, hold his good eye open," I said to Walt. He reached down and peeled back the eyelid, exposing his now lifeless brown eye. I zoomed in and shot a tight photo of it. While I shot pictures, Will was with the women and children on the balcony. Below us, my teammates were collecting all of the computers, memory cards, notebooks, and videos. Outside, Ali, the CIA interpreter, and the security team were dealing with curious neighbors. Over the radio, I heard Mike talking about the crashed Blackhawk.
"Demo team, prep it to blow," Mike said.
I knew from the radio traffic that the SEAL in charge of demolition and the EOD tech were on their way to the courtyard.
"Hey, we're gonna blow it," the SEAL said.
"Roger that," the EOD tech said.
He started taking out charges and putting them around the ground floor of the main house.
"What the fuck?"
the SEAL said as the EOD tech unpacked. Everybody was confused.
"You told me to get ready to blow it, right?"
"Not the house," the SEAL said. "The helo."
"What helo?"
The EOD tech thought the SEAL meant they were going to blow the house, which was another one of the contingency plans we had trained for. News of Chalk One's crash was still not widespread. People were just finding out about it. In Washington, they weren't even sure we'd crashed when they watched it on the drone feed. I heard later it looked on the grainy black-and-white video as if we'd parked in the courtyard and let the team out. The president and senior staff were confused when it happened, and even asked JSOC what was going on. A quick message to McCraven came back with an answer, "We will now be amending the mission. We have a helicopter down in the courtyard. My men are prepared for this contingency, and they will deal with it." Outside, the helicopter crew was done destroying all of the classified gear. Teddy, the senior pilot and flight lead, was one of the last to climb out. Getting to the door, he looked at the almost 6-foot drop to the ground. There was no way he wanted to jump and risk injury. Kicking the fast rope out of the cabin, he slid down to the courtyard, which made him the only guy to fast rope into the compound that night. The EOD tech and the SEAL got there soon after and started to place explosive charges around the fuselage. Climbing up the tail, the SEAL tried to get charges as close to the tail rotors as possible. Wearing his kit and night vision goggles wasn't the easiest way to climb up the unstable, narrow section of tail boom. Each time he tried to reach the section propped over the 12-foot wall, he was afraid it would break under his weight. Climbing up as high as he could, he placed the charges with one hand. The other hand kept him stable as he balanced precariously over the courtyard. Destroying the communications equipment and avionics was the most important part. With the charges set on the tail, he placed the remaining charges in the main cabin. Meanwhile, the Blackhawk that hadn't crashed and the CH-47 carrying the QRF were flying in circles nearby, waiting for us to finish. Fuel was becoming an issue, which meant our time in the compound was shrinking quickly.
10 minutes, I heard Mike say over the radio.
On the third deck, the lights in the room came on, bathing us in the glow of white light. The rolling blackout was apparently over. It was perfect timing and made everything easier. While I continued shooting pictures, Walt took DNA samples. He dabbed a cotton swab in Bin Laden's blood. He took another and jammed it in Bin Laden's mouth to get a saliva sample. Finally, he took out a spring-loaded syringe the CIA gave us to get a marrow blood sample. We'd been trained to jab it into the thigh to get a sample from inside the femur. Walt jabbed it several times into Bin Laden's thigh, but the needle wouldn't fire.
"Here," I said, handing him mine. "Try this one."
He took it and slammed my syringe into the fleshy part of Bin Laden's thigh, but it also didn't fire.
"Fuck these things," Walt said, tossing the syringes to the side.
I finished taking a second set of pictures using another SEAL's camera. We took two DNA samples and sets of photos so that we had identical sets. Walt put one sample in his cargo pocket and gave another to a SEAL in the other chalk. This had been carefully planned, so if one of the helicopters was shot down on our flight back to Jalalabad, a DNA sample and set of pictures would survive. We wanted proof to show to Pakistan and the rest of the world we got Bin Laden. Meanwhile, on the balcony, Will was trying to get confirmation that it was Bin Laden on the floor. His wife, Amal, who had been wounded in the ankle, was still hysterical and wouldn't talk. I could hear her whimpering on the bed above me while I worked. The other woman, her eyes puffy from crying, tried to keep a stern face as Will asked her over and over again in Arabic who the dead guy was.
"What is his name?"
"The Sheikh,"
the woman said.
"The Sheikh who?"
Will said. He didn't want to lead her and stuck to open-ended questions. After she gave Will several aliases, he went over to the kids who were outside on the balcony. They were all sitting silently against the wall. Will knelt down and asked one of the girls, "Who is the man?" The girl didn't know to lie.
Osama bin Laden.
Will smiled.
Are you sure that is Osama bin Laden?
Yes,
the girl said.
Okay, he said. Thanks. Back in the hallway, he grabbed one of the wives by her arms and gave her a good shake.
Stop fucking with me now, Will said, more sternly than before. Who is that in the bedroom?
She started to cry, more scared than anything else. She didn't have any fight left.
Osama,
she said.
Osama what? Will said, still holding her arm.
Osama bin Laden,
she said. Will moved her back outside with the kids and walked back into the bedroom.
Hey, dual confirmation, Will said. Confirmed it with the kid, confirmed it with the old lady. Both are saying the same thing.
As Will left the room, Jay showed up with Tom. Seeing the body, he came and stood over it.
Will confirmed through a woman and a kid that it is UBL, Tom said. Kneeling next to his head, I pulled his beard to the left and right so Jay could get the profile shot. I had my SSE card and put it next to his face so Jay could see the real bin Laden next to the CIA renderings.
Yeah, that looks like our guy, Jay said.
Jay immediately left the room to call it in. The rest of us went back to work.
Once outside, Jay got on the satellite radio to Admiral McRaven, who was still in Jalalabad.
The Admiral was keeping President Obama and the rest of the Situation Room in the White House updated on our progress.
For God and country, I passed Geronimo, Jay said. Geronimo, E-K-I-A.
Over the troop net, I could hear the guys on the second deck. They needed more help to gather up all of the intelligence in the media rooms. It was on the second floor that bin Laden had a makeshift office where he kept his computers and made his video pronouncements. The rooms were immaculate and organized. Everything had its place. All of his CDs, DVDs, and memory cards were stacked up perfectly. The SEALs focused on grabbing all the electronic media, recorders, memory cards, thumb drives, and computers. The CIA had briefed us on what type of digital voice recorder they thought bin Laden used, and had even showed us one that was similar during our training. The SEALs searching the second floor actually found one exactly like the CIA had predicted. I marveled again at the intelligence team. When Jen had pronounced 100%, I should have believed her. When we were done with the DNA samples and photos, Walt and another SEAL grabbed bin Laden's legs and pulled him out of the room. With all the commotion and activity going on around me, I can still remember watching the guys drag his body down the stairs. I stayed in the room and started gathering up any intelligence I could find. The office was barren of anything useful. I grabbed a few papers, possibly religious writings, and took some audio cassettes and threw them into a mesh bag. We all carried the lightweight, collapsible bags for this purpose.
A quick search of the tiny bathroom with green tile on the walls had revealed nothing of value.
I did find a box of Just for Men hair dye, which he must have used on his beard.
No wonder he looked so young when we found him.
On the wall between the bathroom and office, I opened up a wooden freestanding dresser. It was about 6 feet tall, with two long doors. Inside were several sets of clothes, including the long shirts, baggy pants, and vests common to the region. I was shocked by how neat it was.
Compared to some parts of his house,
which looked like hoarders lived there, his dresser could have passed a Marine Corps boot camp inspection. All of his T-shirts were folded into squares and stacked in one corner. His clothes hung evenly spaced. This could be my dresser, I thought. I grabbed a few shirts and a vest and stuffed them in my bag. I knew we were there to collect mostly electronic media, but since there wasn't much of that in the room, I figured I'd grab this stuff instead. Throwing open the drawers at the bottom, I rifled through his stuff, looking for anything useful. For the most part, his room appeared to be for sleeping. Before I left, I noticed a shelf that ran above the door. It was just above where he was standing when we got to the third deck. I slid my hand up and felt two guns, which turned out to be an AK-47 and a Makarov pistol in a holster. I took each weapon down and pulled out the magazine and checked the chambers. They were both empty. He hadn't even prepared a defense. He had no intention of fighting. He asked his followers for decades to wear suicide vests or fly planes into buildings, but didn't even pick up his weapon. In all of my deployments, we routinely saw this phenomenon. The higher up the food chain the targeted individual was,
the bigger a pussy he was.
The leaders were less willing to fight. It is always the young and impressionable who strap on the explosives and blow themselves up. Bin Laden knew we were coming when he heard the helicopter. I had more respect for Ahmed al-Kuwaiti in the guest house because at least he tried to defend himself and his family. Bin Laden had more time to prepare than the others, and yet he still didn't do anything. Did he believe his own message? Was he willing to fight the war he asked for? I don't think so. Otherwise, he would have at least gotten his gun and stood up for what he believed. There is no honor in sending people to die for something you won't even fight for yourself. Over the radio, I could hear updates from the team on the security perimeter. Ali and the four SEALs spent most of our time on target holding security along the road northeast of the compound. After they were inserted, two assaulters and Cairo, the combat assault dog, did a sweep of the perimeter. After the patrol, they waited and watched for onlookers to come out and investigate the commotion. Residents heard the helicopters, the intermittent explosions, and gunfire. Wondering what was going on, a few small groups approached the security team.
"Go back inside," Ali said in Pashto. "There is a security operation underway."
Luckily for us, the Pakistanis obliged and went back into their houses. A few posted messages on Twitter about helicopters and noise. Time was getting tight. Mike was on the radio giving us remaining time hacks. We'd been in the compound for almost 30 minutes. Each time he came on, my teammates on the second deck asked for additional time.
"We need 10 more minutes," a SEAL on the second deck said. "We're not even halfway done."
Mike just repeated the time back, calmly. The mission was a balancing act. We all wanted to stay and make sure we didn't leave anything behind, but the helicopters were running out of fuel, and there wasn't any time to give.
"Post-assault 5 minutes," Mike finally said. That meant drop what you're doing and get to the landing zone within 5 minutes.
I was done on the third deck, and I started for the door. I felt like I was leaving something undone. We took pride in coming back with every bit of intelligence we could find and collect. There was so much still to do. We all had to face the fact we were leaving areas unsearched, and then put it out of our minds. We all knew the risks of running out of gas, or remaining on target too long, giving the local police or military time to react. We got what we came for. Bin Laden. It was time to get out while we still could.
"Hey, consolidate the women and children and get them out of the compound," Mike said over the radio.
I could hear Will trying to get the women and children to move outside. We didn't want them to wander over to the helicopter before it exploded. But it was like herding cats, and Will wasn't making any headway. The women were still sobbing, and the kids were either crying or sitting in a daze. None of them wanted to move. I didn't have time to help. I still needed to get over to C compound. I followed the smear of blood from Bin Laden's body. It left a slippery trail all the way to the first deck, where Walt had put Bin Laden's body into a body bag. As I climbed down the steps, I could see where they dragged the body over Khalid's body. His son's white shirt was stained with his father's blood. I headed for C1. The others had gotten photos and DNA of al-Kuwaiti. When I got there, his wife and kids were squatting in the corner of the courtyard. I tried to get them up and moving when Mike's urgent call came across the radio.
"Hey, guys," he said, "drop what you're doing and move to Exfil HLZ.
Low on fuel, the Black Hawk and the C-47 were inbound to pick us up. Using arm signals, I got al-Kuwaiti's family up and shepherded them into the guest house. I knew the charges on the helicopter were going off nearby. This was going to be a big explosion, but the guest house was far enough away. They'd be safe if they stayed inside the room. Once inside, I tried to get across the idea that there was going to be a big explosion, using my hands and making an explosion sound. "Stay here," I said in English. I have no idea if they understood. I backed out of the room and shut the door behind me. Racing down the rutted driveway, I saw Teddy and the other helicopter crew standing near Mike. They looked funny in their large aviation helmets and Army ACU uniforms. They looked lost and out of their environment, uncomfortable with actually being on the ground.
I looked at Mike as I passed.
"The women and kids are staying in C1, I said. "There is no way I can move them." The SEALs from the second deck were spilling out of the building. We looked like a gypsy camp or like Santa Claus on Christmas Eve. Guys had mesh bags over their shoulders so full they seemed to waddle more than run. I saw one SEAL carrying a CPU in one hand and a leather gym bag overflowing in the other. The SEALs on the second floor had collected so much intelligence material that they had run out of the collapsible bags that they carried and started taking bags that they found in the house and filling them, too.
SEALs carried 1950s leather briefcases like they were on their way to the office,
and knock-off Adidas athletic bags as if heading home from the gym. Outside the gate, I turned right and sprinted toward the rest of the guys who were beginning to line up in our chalk loads. I could see the snipers had already set up the landing zone. My chalk was going to exfil on the remaining Blackhawk because we had the body. The smaller, more maneuverable aircraft had less of a chance of being shot down. The CH-47 would pick up all the SEALs from Chalk 2, as well as Teddy and his crew from the crashed Blackhawk. All around us, lights in the houses were on. I could see several heads in the windows watching us. Ali was barking in Pashto for them to go back inside. We started to get a head count. I was missing Will.
"Where's Will?" I said, moving down the line. "He was getting the kids and women when I left," Walt said, standing next to the body, ready to move it to the helicopter.
I started to get on the radio to try and find his location when I saw Will run out of the compound. He was the last one out. Taking my place near Walt on the body bag, I could make out the Blackhawk coming in right on top of the IR strobe in the field. As the helicopter flared out, I looked down, shielding my eyes from the cloud of dust and debris from the rotors. Once the cloud passed, we picked up the body and took off on a dead sprint toward the waiting helicopter. This was our freedom bird, and we weren't going to miss it. The field was recently plowed, and we stumbled over 18-inch mounds of earth as we hustled the 100 yards to the helicopter carrying the 6'4" body. We looked like drunks stumbling and falling our way to the bird. The dead weight wasn't easy to carry for any of us, but Walt had a tough time trying to stay upright. Being 5'6" tall, his stride was much shorter than the rest of us. Every few steps, he'd fall over one of the mounds. With curse words cascading from his lips, he'd bounce back up and press on. Racing under the spinning rotors, we threw the body on the deck and quickly climbed aboard. I found a spot up against the back of the pilot's seats. After the sprint, we were exhausted. My chest was heaving, trying to gulp in air.
"Holy shit, we're gonna pull this off," I thought.
When we didn't immediately leap into the sky, I got anxious. In Afghanistan, the helicopter was practically taking off with the last boot still on the ground. The longer we waited, the more I prepared for a rocket-propelled grenade to tear through the door.
"Go, go, go," I kept thinking. "Come on, man, go, go."
But the Blackhawk waited. It even throttled back. The pilots didn't want to take off before the CH-47 arrived. Helicopters like to fly in pairs. The charges on the downed Blackhawk were seconds away from exploding. The SEAL and EOD tech put the charges on a 5-minute timer. That would have been plenty of time if we'd been on schedule. But we were running late. At this point, we were 8 minutes past our planned drop-dead time. We factored in 10 extra minutes, but we were about to run out of that, too. We had to assume law enforcement and Pakistani military were inbound and headed to investigate the situation. We were an invading military force who had entered their sovereign territory. I could see the expression on Tom's face. He was on the helicopter's intercom radio trying to figure out what was going on. He wanted the pilots to hurry up and lift off.
"Let's go," he finally said. "We have to take off right now."
Less than a minute remained on the explosive charges on the downed Blackhawk. The SEAL who set the charges ran up to Jay and grabbed him. They were both still on the landing zone waiting for the CH-47 to arrive. Jay had been so focused on getting the helicopters in safely, he hadn't heard his name being called.
"Call off the 47, the SEAL said to Jay. "You need to get all the birds out of the immediate area. The charge is going to blow in under 30 seconds.
Jay started to work the radios. He knew the explosion would knock the inbound CH-47 out of the sky, and shrapnel would destroy the idling Blackhawk. I heard the rotors come to life, and the Blackhawk quickly climbed into the sky. Swinging to the northeast, we picked up speed. Seconds after takeoff, I saw a big flash of light. The explosion bathed the cabin in light for a second, before it faded back to black. The CH-47 flew around to the south and landed after the explosion. The remaining SEALs and the air crew loaded up on the helicopter. Since they'd burned up so much fuel loitering, the CH-47 didn't have any to spare. and with the extra weight of the additional seals on board, they had just enough gas to head straight back to the base in Jalalabad. Closing my eyes, I took a deep breath. The cabin was dark. The only lights were from the dashboard in the cockpit, and from where I was sitting, I could just make out a few gauges on the console, including the gas gauge. Right when I thought I could relax, I noticed the gas gauge was blinking red. I'm not a pilot, but I knew enough to realize that blinking red lights in a cockpit were never a good sign. Chapter 17. Exfil. I kept peeking into the cockpit to watch the flashing red lights on the gas gauge. From the briefs leading up to the mission, I remembered it was only supposed to take 10 minutes to reach the FARP site. I could feel the helicopter bank and make a wide turn like we were water circling a drain. We seemed to be doing laps around a particular area. The crew chiefs were at the doors, scanning the ground from the windows. From the corner of my eye, I could see that the red blinking line on the fuel gauge was even smaller. Once again, we were jammed into the cabin. Tom was sitting next to me. Walt had to sit on Bin Laden's body, which was lying at my feet in the center of the cabin. Soon after takeoff, my legs started falling asleep, and I tried to wiggle my toes to keep the blood circulating. I knew that in the big scheme of events, our portion of the night's work was now done. Still, none of us could relax until we got fuel and were safely across the border. Looking back into the dark cabin again, I forced the fuel issue out of my mind. We were all type A guys who liked to be in control. About 38 minutes ago, all I wanted to do was push the rope out of the helicopter, slide down it, and assault the compound. Now, with that portion of the mission accomplished, I was again stuck in a helicopter with nothing to do. What good was worrying about fuel going to do? I wasn't a pilot. The red blinking lights could be Christmas lights for all I knew. The helicopter did another long loop before banking hard and quickly descending into a hover. The crew chief threw open the door, and I could finally see the dark silhouette of a CH-47 about 50 yards away. Some of the SEALs from the other squadron were pulling security in the waist-high grass. As we touched down, they were on one knee facing away from the helicopter, scanning the horizon for signs of the Pakistani military or police. Rotor wash whipped the grass around them. A pair of army fuelers wearing goggles to protect their eyes from debris hauled a hose up to the Blackhawk. As the rotors spun, they connected the hose to the fuel tank. "To save on weight, they want 4 or 5 of us to get off and ride back with the 47, Tom shouted over the noise of the helicopter. With the additional weight from the body and a full fuel tank, we needed to lighten the load. The pilots were going to err on the side of safety. I saw a couple of guys get off, including Charlie. Back in Abbottabad, the explosion at the compound had finally attracted the attention of the Pakistani military. Unknown to us, they grounded all of their aircraft and started a headcount. With everyone accounted for, they scrambled 2 F-16 fighters armed with 30mm cannons and air-to-air missiles. Pakistan's military had always maintained a state of high alert against India. Most of the country's air defenses are aimed east toward that threat. The jets roared into the sky and raced toward the Abbottabad area. Sitting in the helicopter, I checked my watch. I was impatient and wanted to get back to Jalalabad. I wanted to get out and help. We all did, but I knew the fuelers had a job just like we had our job. If I tried to help, it would only slow things down. And right now, the success of the mission hinged on the fuelers getting the helicopter airborne again. The lone CH-47 that extracted the guys from Chalk 2 was long gone when the jets arrived over the compound.
I watched as the fuelers snapped the hoses off our helicopter and dragged them back toward the CH-47.
The rotors on the helicopter were starting to spin as the fuelers rolled the hose back up the ramp. The security team peeled back and got on board. One after the other, both helicopters lifted off and headed west for Afghanistan. No more blinking lights. Now all we needed to do was get back across the border. I checked my watch again. It took us 20 minutes to refuel. In my mind, I could see Pakistani jets chasing us. I didn't know then, but the F-16s circled around Abbottabad before widening their search. My brain went back to the booklet on Pakistan's air defenses. There was no chance they didn't know we were there. I just hoped we had a big enough lead on anything chasing us. For the first time since getting the 10-minute call before the assault, I finally took my helmet off. Running my hand through my matted, sweaty hair, I forced all thoughts of jets and air-to-air missiles out of my head. We had roughly 45 minutes until we got back to Jalalabad, and I didn't want to sit there and worry. I was grateful when Tom gave us something to do.
Let's search the body again and make sure we didn't miss anything.
Walt climbed off of Bin Laden's chest and put on a pair of rubber gloves. I slid